Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their teardrop trailer that they have nicknamed Maggie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. For the past 3 years, they have been filming a documentary about heritage breed animals entitled The Holstein Dilemma, Heritage Breeds, and the Need for Biodiversity. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people. Here's one of those interviews.
Hi, this is Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. Our next interview is with Bob Quinn from Big Sandy, Montana. Bob Quinn is a character. Our other Bob, Bob Doxey, was from Montana as well, and I'm beginning to think they grow them that way up there. Bob and his family have lived in Big Sandy, Montana for probably as long as anyone around there can remember. If you listen to our podcast with the Crabtrees at Velika's Farms, you might remember that Bob is a close neighbor of theirs in Montana Miles. If you draw a line due east from Flathead Lake near Glacier National Park and due north from Yellowstone National Park, the intersection will probably land near Bob's front lawn. Bob Quinn. Bob's proper introduction would be to say that he is an organic farmer who's the founder of Kamut International. He is a passionate advocate of organic agriculture, an author, and successful businessman. That's the formal part, but in no way does that convey the force of nature that is Bob Quinn. Okay, I'm half German, so I have to start the conversation with the food part. Food was one of the main things my parents firmly believed was critical to anyone's comfort. There was always an extra place setting handy, and they would feed anyone who walked in the door at any given moment. Our school friends, neighbors who dropped by, and the Fuller Brush Man, among others, would inevitably end up at the kitchen table with a plate of something and a chat. And this is exactly what happened with Bob. When we first set up the interview prior to heading up to Big Sky Country, among the first questions he asked was, "Would you like breakfast, lunch, or dinner? I'll make you a bite. I can make pancakes if you like them." Well, I decided then and there that these were my people. We chose lunch considering that we had a bit of a drive in order to reach him and didn't know how long it might take. When we showed up at his house, he welcomed us in and started cooking immediately. A bite ended up being a sautéed mix of homegrown parsnips, chard, onions, garlic, and squash, a shredded fried potato pancake that took up the entire pan, and fresh sautéed asparagus. Fresh, as in he took us out to his garden bed and cut the stuff in front of us, and we were eating it 15 minutes later. I have a new appreciation for the difference between fresh asparagus and fresh asparagus. On all of the above, I took heaping seconds just to be polite, and I want credit for not helping myself to thirds and fourths. Bob is a good cook. We set up for the sit-down part of our interview in the front room, and the first thing you saw through the large, wide windows were the wide fields visible as far as your eye could see. A large stone fireplace his father built takes up one wall of the room, and the polished wood piano takes up about another third of the space. A comfy sofa, two chairs, a large grandfather clock, a music stand, and Bob's trombone collection take up the remainder. We had a wonderful interview with Bob as we sat in that front room. He played an old hymn for me on his trombone, and afterwards he was very patient with my bad piano playing, as we played a quick verse of Heart and Soul. He said that his wife will accompany his trombone on the piano when she's not quilting, which is her first love, from the sound of it. Bob is interested in way too many things to cover in one podcast, and is a true Renaissance man. I have the feeling he's very much the mad scientist of the Northern Plains. After our conversation at the house, we had a chance to see some of his past, current, and future projects. We went down to the experimental plots at the front of the house, where he's testing different varieties of seeds and how they react to different conditions, most especially dryland farming. It's obvious that he may have somewhat retired from large-scale farming, but not from his interest in how things grow and how they might grow better. He showed us his root cellar, which may seem basic to some of you, but to me was really interesting, as nobody I know has a basement in California. He showed us what he calls his barn, which looks like that from the outside, but it's pretty pristine inside. He's running what looks to my uneducated eye like a huge industrial-grade tractor engine going across one wall, with pistons across the top in a row and little bits of material slowly being ejected from holes and growing ropes across the bottom. It looks like something out of the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory movie. This is his safflower oil press. For the last 5 years, he's been producing his own brand of organic safflower oil called, appropriately enough, the Oil Barn. Bob is a bit of a philosopher as well, and he said that the safflower field harvest every year puts him in a reflective mood, as it's the final field harvest of the season and a sign of oncoming fall and winter. At the very end of our tour, Bob took us into Big Sandy to see one of his latest projects, a new company called Big Sandy Organics. They make Cracklin' Kamut, which is a yummy toasted grain snack, something like Corn Nuts, but without the orthodonture expense. Bob sent us home with samples of Cracklin' Kamut to give away, but I asked him to tape the box well so everything inside would make it home. I've ordered a few bags for my relatives to try from Amazon, where you can have it delivered to your door in 2 days. It's obvious that Bob feels strongly about keeping jobs in Big Sandy, and he's doing all he can toward that end. Bob doesn't limit himself to the plains of Montana. The day after we were there, he was leaving early for Washington, D.C., where he and a group of organic farmers were going to talk to our representatives to try to encourage forward movement and positive change for organic farming in Montana agriculture. Since Bob has been an organic farmer for 30 years and has some serious experience in the growing, marketing, and distribution of organic products, he's a wonderful representative for old and new ideas whose time have come. And the last part of Bob's busy life has to do with how we met Bob and the Montana Organic Farming Bunch in the first place. In the monster pile that is my reading list sits a book by Liz Carlisle called Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. Gotta say, I love that title. Anyway, she wrote about Bob Quinn, the Crabtrees, and other farmers in Montana, and their attempt to be outrageously rebellious by planting and marketing a crop that not many growers wanted to try, regardless of how nutritious it was and how well-suited it was for the dry Montana landscape. I understand it was a bit of an uphill battle, but if you've purchased black beluga lentils from Timeless Seeds, I get mine from Whole Foods, you know that they met with success. We plan on bringing you that story straight from Liz and hope to do so within a month or so. But Liz's next book was co-authored by the man himself and is Bob's story. It's entitled Grain by Grain, A Quest to Revive Ancient Wheat, Rural Jobs, and Healthy Food. Bob was on his day off from travel for a quick stop home when we spoke with him on his farm. I'm tired just thinking about the activity in this man's life, but he doesn't seem to stop. None of the good ones do. So now, we bring you organic farmer, businessman, agrarian activist, trombonist, author, mad scientist, marketing guru, and wonderful cook, Bob Quinn. So tell me your name and tell me a little bit about yourself and your farm.
Well, my name is Bob Quinn. I'm third generation on this farm, wheat and cattle rancher. This farm was started by my grandfather in 1920, and so next year we'll celebrate 100-year anniversary. I was raised here, as was my father, and my children were raised here. I went to school, local schools in Big Sandy, to Montana State University for college, studying botany and plant pathology, my passion for plants and science. And so I wanted to combine those two, and then I went on for a PhD to UC Davis in California. And after 10 years of university, I was a little disillusioned with the whole university scene, so I came back to the farm, and now my whole farm is my laboratory and my garden.
UC Davis is quite a different environment from farming out here in Montana, correct?
Oh, yes. I thought it was heaven. I went there. You could grow crops all year round. You could grow so many different things that we only dream about here. I was in Woodland for a couple of years north of Davis. We had orange trees and grapefruit in my backyard. I had a garden that I could grow 12 months of the year. It was amazing. The agriculture there was amazing.
And many people don't know, but that's the Sacramento River Delta, so there's water everywhere as well, even in California. That seems weird, but very different from here.
Yes, it's yes. Well, everything was. We had plenty of water in the winter time. Everything, lots of rain, and of course we irrigated our garden in the summer. But it was very hot and dry in the summer. So not so different than here in the summer.
Now you quickly went past those degrees. Technically, you have You have 3 degrees. You have PhD.
Yes.
But they're mostly plant around.
Yes, the plant biochemistry was my PhD, and my undergraduate bachelor's degree was in botany, and my master's is in plant pathology.
So you understand the science and the technical end of plants as well as the innate farming history that you have in your blood.
Well, I have a passion for plants, a real feel for plants, but I also love to study them on a scientific basis. So I know a lot. I don't know everything, of course, about them, but I know how they function and their parts and their cycles and how important they are to us and how they integrate with the rest of the environment.
And you're actually doing a little bit of manipulation, and I wouldn't say manipulation, but you're studying how plants grow differently in different environments. You do some experiments here on the farm. Tell us about that.
I'm always pushing the edges because I think that's where you learn. If we just stick in the secure middle, we don't learn very much. And for me, the exciting things are trying what's new. We have a peach tree in my orchard, and it doesn't last but 2 or 3 years. But when I was a kid, we never dreamed of such a thing. The climate change has made some of this necessary, but also has allowed for some experimentations that would have just been dreams a few years ago. When I was a kid, I grew watermelons every year in my garden. At least I planted them. I never got anything bigger than a softball, and they never were ripe, and they never were any good. But I loved watermelon, and I never gave up trying. And after I was gone for 10 years and back here for another 10 or 15, I decided to try some watermelon again and about 15 years ago. And it was 23 pounds. And it's delicious.
Same land.
Yes, same farm. And this is in my garden. And now I've experimented to the point where we're trying them in dry land out in the field. And planting them without any extra water, just early in the spring as we can, with avoiding the frost and letting them just grow and giving them lots of room and no competition with weeds. And they're producing fabulous watermelons and cantaloupes and other types of melon that we never would have imagined. I would have never imagined you could grow dry land before. So those are the kind of experiments, Eli, that I've really been having fun with. Doing dryland vegetables that we know the pioneers and the homesteaders did because they had no refrigeration. They had no freezer trucks that came in from California. They had none of that. And so whatever they ate, they had to grow.
Now, you've said a couple of times, and this is a new term that I've learned up here, that I've heard it, but I don't really understand it. Explain the difference to the layperson between dryland farming and what regular farming that other people might associate with.
Well, dryland farming is peculiar to the West, but the Intermountain West, the Great Plains, where we're out of the Ogallala, where we don't have water to pump out of the ground. Our soil or groundwater is quite alkaline and full of sodium, so it'll ruin the soil if we irrigate with it. The rivers are few and far between compared to the landmass, and so we've had to learn to farm in this area at least on 12 to 14 inches of rainfall. That's about one-third of what you'd get in Iowa, Ohio, Illinois, going further east in the Midwest. And they can grow, of course, corn and things that are much more abundance than we can grow here. We grow small grains. Corn is a large grain, for example. And by the time you get to the middle of the Dakotas coming west, you're into the short grass prairie. And so short grass prairie is dry land, and it's the semi-arid. That's the next thing to the desert. Now, by the time you get to the desert, then you really do need to irrigate if you're going to have any crops of substantial measure at all. And that's, of course, very common in Arizona and through Central Valley, California, and Southern California, that sort of thing. That's really getting close, and sometimes it is desert. In other areas, it's just close to desert. And we're somewhere in between that. And so we have enough rain, 12 and 14 inches gives us nice crops. If we grow only every other year. So we grow our cash crop 1 year, and then when we fallow the ground, which means that we don't grow a crop on it the second year. And we're saving water during that second year. Traditionally, that fallow ground was tilled to keep the weeds down. In the last couple of decades, the stubble is left standing, and people, instead of tilling, are spraying with glyphosate and Roundup. That's why we have glyphosate contamination everywhere. There's 4.5 billion pounds of glyphosate used, and in our area, most of that use is not on GMO crops or Roundup Ready, because there's no Roundup Ready wheat, but it's used 3 or 4 times a year on most of the chem fallow ground, which is the majority of the fields now. In organic systems, which is what we've been doing the last 30 years, we are growing a green manure cover crop that adds mostly legumes that add nitrogen and feed the soil on that fallow year. And we terminate those crops by early June or mid-June at the latest, so that we conserve water then from mid-June to the rest of the summer. And we found that compared to black fallow, where you're cultivating, we can raise a crop of nitrogen or soil feeding material that we work into the ground and have the same water conservation at the end of the season as the black fallow has. We don't have quite as much water as the standing stubble, the no-till people have. And I've been experimenting for years trying to figure out no-till organic systems and really haven't been successful yet. But it's just a matter of time till we can get it figured out and resources. So that's really the difference. The difference is that we can only grow one crop in 2 years, and where they have plenty of water, sometimes they can grow 2 or 3 crops in 1 year. So that's a huge, huge difference. And the land values represent that too.
But you don't irrigate. You don't put piping out. You basically go with what the land gives you in a way, it seems like.
Yeah, and what the heavens send.
Yeah.
As far as rainfall.
Yes. Now, you just talked about cover crops, and I've done a little bit of research on it. I'm not a farmer, but they do smother the weeds in a way, because the plants that you plant, vetch or winter wheat or whatever it happens to be, will smother the weeds and add nitrogen to the soil. It's our nitrogen fixing plants, mm-hmm. so you get that benefit. But they also add organic material mm-hmm. to the ground, and that's carbon fixing. Now that's the one thing that the average person probably understands, is the term carbon sequestration, or has heard of that. So tell me how what you're doing actually helps the environment when it's helping you.
Well, actually, agriculture has both the seeds of the problem of climate change, because of the great reliance on particularly chemical fertilizers, which put an enormous amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It's made with petroleum products and gas. And high temperatures, but also on the other side of the spectrum, it holds in its hands also the solution. So we're on the one extreme creating part of the problem, and on the other side we have part of the solution right in our hands, because with organic systems, regenerative organic systems, which is the only kind that really is sustainable, we are putting back that carbon from the atmosphere, fixing in plants, like you say, which are then tilled into the ground or let to lie on top of the ground as mulch and eventually go into the soil. And they feed the soil and adding carbon, increasing the carbon base in the organic manner of that soil. So there's if the whole world were to go organic and do regenerative organic agriculture, there would be enough carbon taken out of the atmosphere to almost reverse what we've done up to this point. It doesn't mean that we can keep going with the way we're keep putting carbon into the atmosphere, but we could use it as a step back, as a kind of a reset on our clock, and then use some more practical or imaginative ways to reduce the emissions in the future. Because that's really only a one-time event. I mean, you go back to a certain level of putting carbon in the soil, and then everything is kind of static. It's turning over then. It's both going out and coming in. But now the soils are, by and large, so diminished with carbon that it really offers a huge bank or sink that could be utilized.
Now, you served us a delicious lunch.
And thank you.
That was absolutely wonderful. But over lunch, we talked about something that I was really fascinated by, because it didn't really occur to me. You've talked about regenerative agriculture not being part of our normal history here so far in this country, how westward expansion and our parents and grandparents moved across and how they impacted the land and then left. Could you talk about that again in its entirety?
Well, that didn't happen to everybody, of course, but particularly in the South where the ground was used for cotton and tobacco, by and large. Those are very heavy feeders, and if the ground, the soil is not replenished, it will wear out very, very fast. And even some of the pioneers and forefathers of a country like Jefferson and Washington, they already understood this. But they were the minority. A lot of the farmers would just come and farm the land, use up the soil or the nutrition of the soil, and then they would move west. My family's, my dad's side at least, started in Pennsylvania, moved to Ohio, moved to Iowa, moved to Washington State, and back to some of them moved to Nebraska, and they switched over to Alberta. Some moved back to Idaho, and then ended up in Montana. So they're going mostly west and a little bit back east from the extreme, but they were. Two things were going on. Either the kids were not the oldest and they weren't inheriting the farm, or the farm was becoming less productive. And we were just starting in this area to reach the point where the soils were being depleted of their natural nutrition and viability. And there were some experiments just beginning about the time of World War II for replenishing that with cover crops and with legumes and different rotations. There wasn't very much that they saw in the 30s and in the 40s. They didn't really see big differences because the ground still had a fair amount of nutrition in it. But some of the people in the East had started to see this. But when the chemicals came in as a artificial replacement to nutrition in the soil, and they started focusing on feeding the plants instead of feeding the soil, it's quite a different perspective. They had some instant success with that. And so then the focus turned away from feeding the soil just to feeding the plants. And we still had soil degradation. And the Dust Bowl was part of that. The Dust Bowl was caused by a lot of the fallowing that I told you about. That's not done in plowing. We never plow here. We don't use the plow. We use cultivators, which disturb the ground much less, but we don't turn it over like a plow does and expose all of that soil to the wind. We can't afford to do that. It'll blow away for sure the first year. So we are using the stubble and the plant, the material that's growing on top of the ground and incorporate it just in the first couple inches. And so there's a lot of material on top of the ground and then just right below the surface that's holding the soil together. And that's what we try to do to conserve the soil and keep it from eroding.
And if you use cover crops and things like that, they probably have a tendency to help bind the soil together.
That's even more. That even gives you much more advantage because then you're actually feeding the soil in those off years. Because if you just grow a grain crop and say that summer follows your rotation, well, that's a pretty poor rotation. It's really not adding very much to the soil because you're hauling off a certain amount from that grain crop and you're not putting much in, not putting extra back. With cover crop, you actually replenish the soil. You're putting more in it. You're regenerating. That's where regenerative organic agriculture, the term, comes from.
Now, when you have the crops that you put in and the fallow land next to it, it's in big strips, correct? Would you describe the strips that you have? And so you're not really laying a whole field. You're not letting a whole field go to rest. You're sort of doing it in strips. Is that correct, or is
well,
it both?
When my father, in response to the Dust Bowl, that was very, very common, is to do very narrow strips so we could reduce wind and water erosion. Now with chem fallow, which is reducing erosion, with conservation tillage is what we practice, which is reduced tillage and no plowing, we have less erosion on bigger parcels. And with bigger and bigger machinery, people are going away from this area, at least, away from the narrow strips and going to bigger blocks. But still, the trade-off is always we don't want so big of a block. We want to treat that block in a way that it won't blow away. That's the key. The strips helped us with that, with poor or less imaginative cropping systems. But as we got more complex cropping systems and adding cover crops and green manures, we don't have to have those narrow strips to be successful.
Now, you do quite a bit of crop rotation too, correct?
So organic agriculture is built on two main principles. One's diversity. And so you look out in the prairie, you don't see any monoculture. You see great diversity. In the forest, you see diversity. And along the seashore, you see diversity. In the streams and the rivers, everywhere you look in nature, you see great diversity. There's no monoculture. And when you have monoculture, it's an artificial system. That means you have to have artificial means to sustain it. And that means, in this day and age, that means industrial chemical agriculture. We're trying to switch away from that because we think that that has a lot of high costs. And you don't pay most of them at the checkout stand, at the food counter. Well, we pay them, well, we'll talk about that later maybe. We'll pay them way down the road, either in pollutions or illness or whatever. But in going to regenerative agriculture, we really need to mimic nature. And so the diversity we see in nature, we mimic with crop rotations. And that's one way to do it. And also rotations then break up disease cycles, pest cycles, insect cycles, all of those things are allowed to allow us to grow crops without the use of chemicals and yet not have those crops taken over by weeds or insects or disease. Those are the three things. And if you break up those cycles by not growing the same crop in the same field year after year, you have much better opportunity to be successful. Our goal is not to eliminate all those things to zero. We don't eradicate any of that stuff. It's all part of the circle of life, you might say. But we do try to manage it so it doesn't become an economic deterrent or economic problem to our cash crops. And that's the one principle. And the second principle is soil building. So we have to have some of those crops in our rotation that help build the soil, that are adding back nutrients to the soil rather than just taking it out. If you're just taking nutrients out, you're no different than the mine in mining. And the trouble with that is that every mine has a bottom, and every soil will have a bottom in terms of losing all of its nutrition. Then it's it's not very good for growing crops and nutrition and growing nutrition, nutritious food and plants.
I would say that you're describing dead soil, and you had a great parallel for me, the difference between dirt and soil.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about glyphosate, I think, maybe then. And glyphosate actually not only is a weed killer, but it's an antibiotic. And so the more you spray, I tell people when I'm doing my book tour lectures, I said, the more glyphosate you spray, the deader is your dirt. So if you want really dead dirt, then just keep spraying glyphosate. But if you want living soil that's vibrant and alive and can produce healthy plants, because healthy soil produces healthy plants, then you need to look at some of the things we just got done talking about, the rotations and the soil building components. And then healthy plants, of course, produce healthy food, which is producing healthy people or animals, whoever's eating that. And that's our goal. That should be our goal, not just cheap and abundant food, but nutritious food. And we don't have to worry about sacrificing enough food for people to eat. I mean, we waste almost 50% of the food that's grown on the whole earth. If we just looked at that question, we could cut our food costs. In Western society, most of that waste comes after we buy at the grocery store or including the grocery store. We could cut our grocery bill in half by not wasting anything in the West. In underdeveloped countries, most of that waste comes because it's not adequately protected getting to the grocery store. So they don't have storage and transportation to keep the rain out or the bugs out or the rats or all that kind of stuff. That's where almost half of theirs is lost. But over the whole earth, almost half of the food is lost. Between 40 and 50%, it's enormous. So that's some of the things that could also be addressed that we're not really addressing.
Now, in all of this, in life we try to pigeonhole things.
Yeah,
and as I'm
okay.
listening, I'm trying to figure out where to place you. At lunch, I was thinking that too. He kind of sounds a little bit like a tree hugger. I can classify myself as a tree hugger,
yeah.
So I get that. But I also hear the business in you. I don't really hear you proselytizing about you need to be organic because it's the right thing to do. It sounds like it's just a sensible decision to you from a business perspective, an economic perspective, and a long-term, sort of a long-term monetary perspective. We talked about health impacts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you view it as that? Because
yes.
It seems like you're just a businessman here, and organics and regenerating the soil is just a smart decision. Is that true?
To me, it all comes, all goes together. It's all linked, and we can't have any of this whole program isn't independent. It doesn't stand independent by itself. We are growing food for people to eat. The most of my neighbors are thinking about growing commodities, as though they go into the commodity market and they're done with it, and that's it. It's just gone. We are linked to the people that actually eat what we grow, if we think about it that way. That really changes the perception of what we're doing. We're not just trying to make money growing commodities. I mean, we have to make enough money to be here next year, so it isn't that way. It's a business, and it has to be profitable enough to survive and to progress and to feed our family. That's our goal. My goal wasn't to go to town and get another job or send my wife to town to work to support my family, my farming habit. You know, I felt like we need to add value to what we're doing here in the farm to allow us to be successful financially. But what we're doing is growing food. We're not growing commodities. And so that brings me now to the point of, well, how do you grow healthy food? You grow healthy food by having healthy plants. Well, how do you get healthy plants? You get healthy plants by having healthy soil. Well, where do you get healthy soil from? Well, you feed it and you take care of it, you nourish it, and you don't abuse it, and you don't spray it with a bunch of chemicals that kills everything. So to me, all of that is all linked together. And if it's done right, it can be successful on all those levels, not only nutritionally and health-wise, but also financially and also supporting the community. So all those things are linked. And not abusing our planet, not polluting it, and having dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico that are the size of New Jersey. How big do they need to get before we think we have a problem? We're going in the wrong direction. And the people that are making the most money about this have the most power and the most influence in Washington and don't want to see anything changed. And they're extracting the wealth from middle America, from agriculture, and putting it in their own pockets, this multinational chemical industrial complex is what I call them.
So next week you're going to Washington to try and work on this. Tell me about that. I am.
So we're going to talk about that. So I have a new slogan, and I'm having buttons made. And it's going to say, chemical-free by 43. And
That's rather ambitious, is it not?
Well, it is. But some of my friends don't even think we have that long because of the way soils are deteriorating and health is deteriorating and cancer and autism is skyrocketing, diabetes. I heard a report the other day that said right now in the 70s, autism affected, I think, 1 in 5,000 or something. It was very rare. I never saw anybody with autism as I was growing up. Now it's down to 1 in 37. In Big Sandy, my little hometown here, we have about 70 in the grade school. We have two autistic kids. It's right at the national average. We never saw that. And people say, oh, well, we just didn't diagnose it. Well, if you've seen autistic kids, you don't miss that kind of diagnosis. They don't talk. They don't. They bang their head against the wall. That's not something you're going to miss in diagnosis. That's laughable. And the way the current trends is on that, they're talking about 1 in 3 by 20, 35 or 40 or something, that will break the country. I mean, it's not only it's a tragedy for the families that deal with that, but also the cost of dealing with this kind of a problem with the children is enormous. And we can't have that kind of increase in those kind of diseases and not pay a huge price. It'll bring the whole country to a halt. And this is the kind of thing that I'm always trying to connect food and health and food and nutrition. And if we can do that, then we can start thinking about appreciating adding more value to that food and making it more nutritious and more healthy and thereby paying more for it because it's worth more. Because how do you put a price on an autistic kid not being autistic? You know, if it's as simple as, you know, glyphosate contamination or something like that. That is huge. And so those are some of the kinds of things that I like to rattle the cages about.
It's the positive and the negative direction, correct? I mean, if our food has an apple, I've heard the statistics, is 22% less vitamin A than an apple 50 years ago because we've changed it so much. So you're paying more for the apple. It's the same size apple, but you're not getting as much of what you're paying for. So food, it can have negative impacts mm-hmm. with things like the you know, autism and other conditions that occur, but it can also have, you know, a lack of positive impacts, which might be the same thing, less nutrition in the food that we get. Yeah. And it's all dependent upon how we raise our food, is it not?
It's dependent on three main things that I tell people. And for wheat, I'd say four, but two of them really go together. So it depends, first of all, the seed that you use. Are you using a seed that's been bred for the sole purpose of producing gigantic yields? If you are, you're probably using a seed that's lost some nutritional value along the way. And what we need is better ways to test that more easily. We've seen that in some of the experiments that we've done, some of the research we've done in Italy, but they cost millions of dollars. And we need a quick test to know that when we do a cross in the by plant breeders, and they're looking, yield is fairly easy to measure, but it's not so easy to measure all these nutritional things. If we had an easy way to measure nutrition, then we should be using that as just important, and maybe even more important criteria for plant selection than yields. So that's one thing that's gone in the wrong direction. The other thing that's gone in the wrong direction, I've already talked about and mentioned, is industrial agriculture. We need to go back to regenerative organic agriculture, or go forward to it, maybe I should say, because now we know better how to do it. And that will produce healthier, more nutritious plants and more nutritious food. So that's the second thing. The third thing we've done, particularly in talking about wheat, because that's what I know best, is the processing. So we've made white flour. That's not anything new, except when you're looking at the last 10,000 years, then it's really new. And so is the chemical agriculture. You know, when people talk about conventional agriculture, they mean chemical agriculture. That's not conventional. What's conventional is what we've been doing for the last 10,000 years. That's conventional. What this experiment we're doing for the last 70 years, that's an experiment. That's a chemical experiment. And I predict, my prediction is, that experiment will come to an end. And we'll look back at this period in as much awe as we look back to when we used DDT freely like water, like it was benign. And yet we found later that it wasn't benign. And I think we'll find the same thing. We'll come to the same conclusion eventually with all these wonderful Better Life Through Chemistry ideas. And we'll go back and go forward at the same time using better technology, but back to original principles of conventional agriculture, which really was based on rotations and feeding the soil and producing more nutritious food.
That's really interesting, because commercial and conventional agriculture are often thought of as the same. In my mind, I kind of thought of it not as the same thing, but connected. And they are two different things, but 70 years, you're right. I mean, that's really only the period of time.
Yeah, it's a lifetime. I mean, I'm 70 now. It's been my lifetime. I was born in 47. Chemical agriculture was just being introduced after World War II. That's when I was born. In my lifetime, people my age don't know anything different than that, and yet they call that conventional. And that's a paradox.
So you have quite a bit of land around here, and you've been successful commercially in the markets. Do you think that you can be successful as an organic farmer in terms of production and still be able to produce a great deal of food?
Oh, yes. No question. Well, in Montana, in the Upper Great Plains, we have the advantage of growing our own fertilizer, so we can reduce our inputs dramatically compared to chemical inputs. In areas where they're bringing inputs in for organic, that's not quite the same balance. But for us, and of course our land values are much less than what they have too, where it's rain or irrigated. But we can grow our own inputs, and then we can sell our outputs, our production, for much more money, sometimes twice, sometimes three times, sometimes four, sometimes five, of what our non-organic neighbors are selling their grain for. And by putting those two things together, we're able to, at our farm, we were able to eliminate our operating note, which almost all farmers use, to borrow large amounts of money in the spring and then hopefully pay it off in the fall when they harvested. We were able to completely eliminate that. And in the beginning, in the early 80s, I first started trying to add value to my farm by selling our grain, which is high protein, that was its quality and its high value at that point, directly to whole grain bakers who was looking for high protein in California. And so I started Montana Flour and Grains, which was a brokerage essentially in the beginning. It just bought wheat and sold wheat. And then our customers asked us if we could find organic. So I started buying and selling organic grain. And that got me acquainted with organic farmers and led me to experiments on my own farm to see if it would work here. And it did, and I was thrilled about it. I was an instant convert. And then the next year they asked us for stone ground flour. So we got a stone mill. I didn't know anything about that, but we got one from Austria. They said, just plug it in the wall. Found out that wasn't true because it was wired for European everything. So anyway, it was a typical, you know, salesman pitch. But we figured it out, and we got that to be successful. So we started selling stone ground whole wheat flour. We started into an ancient grain, which we trademarked, which we registered a trademark Kamut to sell. And we found, much to our astonishment, that people could eat this grain, that they couldn't eat modern wheat, and yet they could eat this. Meanwhile, 20% of the people now in this country have trouble eating modern wheat. If I was the wheat farmer, and I am a wheat farmer, right? I think that's disastrous. If 20% of my potential customers no longer could eat my products, you'd think that there would be some concern about that. And yet, with a general population of wheat breeders, they just have their head in the sand about that. They're in denial, and they don't try to figure out what has gone wrong with that.
What is the
staff
price of
life?
What is the price of today's wheat is more important than what is the price of wheat in 3 years and my consumers being around to be able to purchase it for long-term success.
And they focus only on how much yield we can get. The only way we can beat the declining price of our commodity and the increasing cost to raise it is to have more yield. That's the only thing that they look at. And that's just the race to the bottom. And for a lot of farmers, a lot of my neighbors, half of my neighbors in the last 40 years are gone because they didn't win that race. They lost that race. And the chemical companies don't care who wins or loses that race because there's always going to be somebody else that takes over that land and invests their capital and buys their chemicals to keep the whole cycle going for them. But it's a very non-sustainable system.
So you have a video that we watched on YouTube. It's called Ancient Grain for Future Farming.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of encapsulates both of those things that you mentioned, the ancient concept and the future. So how does that encapsulate that thought in that title for you?
Well, the ancient grain really harkens back to a time before we started messing with our seeds. And most of those seeds already had the essence of what we needed for good health. And if you had a mixture, a large enough population of those seeds that were slightly different, that had different resistance to disease and to insects and to crazy climate variations, you would have then less risk making those seeds more successful to have a crop. Now, they weren't the highest yielding crop. They weren't geared to be high yield. They were geared to be diverse and to be high in nutrition. And that's the way they came. But we decided with modern industrialization of agriculture, we only focused on one aspect, and that was high yield. And then we focused on bringing in, let's say, crutches, like herbicides, pesticides, and insecticides, and fungicides, to take care of the deficiencies that we now have in these grains that only had one super attribute, and that was yield. But they didn't have super attributes. Some of them were disease resistant, so we did incorporate that to get higher yields. But a lot of these other things they didn't have anymore. So we have to have all these crutches now to support this monoculture that is very, very specific and very, has no diversity, very little diversity.
Well, this is one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you about this whole concept, because in agriculture, we do have the same issue with the heritage breed animals in this country. Mm-hmm. 92% of our production is just a couple of breeds in each area. And so the monoculture exists as well. You've got great old genetics that are available, and yet they don't yield. Their production is not as high as some of the breeds that they have
now. Yes, yes. It's the same exact thing. And most people don't remember the corn blight of, 1970 or around there. Because the corn, most of the corn in the country was just it was almost genetically identical. So one disease came in, a very unusual or new disease, that was very susceptible to and wiped out a huge percent. Same thing could happen in animals. Same thing could happen in any population that's too narrow in its genetic diversity.
Well, it did happen. Newcastle disease comes through in the 70s.
Yeah,
there
course,
goes our poultry
right.
industry.
Yeah.
You know, the potato famine in Ireland comes
yeah.
through and the blight
yeah.
wipes it out. It's, I can see how it must be difficult, too, though, when you, especially when you have this ancient grain that's really great. And you're a man that believes in, at least in, so far in our conversations, in adapting to the environment and maximizing his environment. How do you weigh that thing that occurs when you want to maximize what you have, and yet you want to maintain the characteristics of the old? Is that a...
Yes. So the way you do that is you focus on the adaptability of different grains. You take the principle of being heritage or ancient or whatever, or old lines in the cattle or whatever in livestock, and then you see where they best fit, and you don't try to force it into one uniform line to the whole world or the whole country or the whole region. You celebrate the diversity rather than moan and groan over it, and people now are starting to appreciate and look for more diversity in their foods, and they like the taste of place sort of thing. We've had that in Europe for years, centuries. And in America, we're not that old to have that. But now people are starting to think about the fun and the value of that. It's interesting. Rather than having watermelon all year round and half the year it's coming from Chile or wherever, and the other half, other quarter from Mexico, and then only in the very short season is it more local. But it's the best when it's more local and it's vine ripened. It's the same with almost all the fruits and vegetables. If you have animals that are really best for Texas, the longhorn steers and the way they were bred, and you bring them to Montana where it's 40 below zero, you know, they're not going to do this quite as well. But why force that? Why force having a breed that's going to be uniform for the whole country and you have to have them in heated sheds or something here? Why not have something that's more adapted? We had buffalo that did just fine here. We still have deer and antelope that do fine. We have Hereford and Angus cows that are really adapted to this area, and they do just fine. And we don't bring exotic breeds in that are really from the tropics or the further south, so far south, that they're not suited for this country. And the same use, I'd say, for plants. The grain that we're working with is under the Kamut brand name, the Coruscant, is very susceptible to black tip. It only comes with rain and high humidity the last 6 weeks before harvest. So we don't go east of Bismarck or east of Saskatchewan in Canada growing this stuff. And we don't complain about that. We don't breed it so it can go to Minnesota. We say, okay, if you're in Minnesota, why don't you grow spelt? Why don't you grow emmer? Why don't you, if you want to grow ancient grain, grow an ancient grain that's not susceptible, that's adaptable to high humidity and more rainfall during the whole season, and not complain because you can't grow, or we shouldn't complain because we can't grow our stuff in Minnesota. That's the idea. So we try to look around the whole world, and you can find in seed banks now different plants that are from different regions, and many of them have, they're adaptable to different regions that will do just fine here. Some will not. And so why cry and moan about that? We try to do what we can do best here and let other people do the same in their own regions.
My dad used to talk about ancient grains and lentils, and it's amazing to think of something that was mentioned that long ago,
yep.
thousands of years ago.
Yep.
Potentially could still be on the tables today, and that we're refining the importance of it.
That's true. I mean, these are wheat was described biblically as the staff of life, and it was the grain that built great civilizations of antiquity. The Babylonians, the Ephesians, the Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptians, and yet in the last 50 years, people treat it like poison and say, I don't eat wheat, I don't eat gluten, I avoid all that stuff. 20% of the population has trouble eating it, but up to 40% are dabbling with wheat-free, gluten-free because it's a faddish, popular thing to do. It's something to talk about their cocktail parties, I guess, and that's what they do. And it's completely, it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that's what I tell them. So the modern wheat we have right now is not as good, and sometimes it's detrimental to 20% of the people, detrimental to their health. But rather than throwing the whole wheat out the window, Let's go back to where it wasn't detrimental, where it was building great civilizations because it was nourishing people, and see what they were doing with it, and see what the difference is between that wheat and the wheat we have today. And when you do that, then you discover or rediscover, as you say, the nutrient value and importance of it.
Yeah, and again, with the heritage breed parallel to that that immediately comes to mind, you save these things because you don't know which one of the things might be important.
That's right.
It's not all wheat that affects everybody, but save all the different kinds.
Yeah.
It's not all cattle or all chickens. It might be the great one that produces, but you know what? You might need this other little one seems unimportant at the time.
Especially if you have things like we have climate change right now. The diversity is our best hedge against climate change and new diseases or new weeds or new whatever that might come, new insect attacks. Diversity is the best hedge because some of these grains and animals have been here thousands of years, and there are some places resistant strains to this. And that's why it's really important to have these seed banks and diversity in preserving animal breeds and that sort of thing. Because we don't know in the future what genetics we might need to overcome the difficulties that we're finding ourselves right now. And I think it's a very short-sighted and a very weak argument to say, well, we don't need to worry about that because we can do gene editing and CRISPR technology now and all this stuff. We have no idea in the world what we're doing with that because the truth is that all those genes are linked together and all that activity affects all the other activity going on in a living system. And even outside that living system, how it the environment affects how those genes are expressed, some of them, and all this stuff. And when you start monkeying with that as though you think, well, I'm just going to change one thing, that's not true. You'd never change just one thing. And that's why I don't think it's fair to condemn at all out of hand, but it's really unwise to accept it all out of hand without demonstrating what else is going on.
So I want you to tell me about grain by grain.
Oh, well, after farming and living here for the last 40 years of my adult life and all the experiments I've been doing, all the experience I've had in different types of business endeavors, some went better than others, I thought that it would be well to share that experience with others so they don't have to, they can kind of build on some of the experience that I've had and not have to start it all over from scratch. And also to encourage people to look at our food system and really seeing what we're doing with it. I think there's a very high cost of our current food system, and that's what I wanted to write about. It's a high cost of cheap food, that's what I say. The cheap food that we demand and buy in the grocery store has a very high price tag, that most of which is not paid for at the grocery store, the checkout counter. The farmers are paying it by not receiving enough to even make a living. They have to have jobs in town to even pay for their farming habit, I'd say. Even though it's a full-time, both of them are full-time, and they're working their heads off just to keep even. There's a high cost to the small communities that once the farmers go broke, which many of them have, and move away, then they can't support the small towns anymore, and many of those businesses are going broke. A very high cost to our planet with all the pollutions of chemical agriculture that don't stay where you put them, but wash down the river and the groundwater into the air. We have glyphosate in our rainwater now that falls on our farm. So they don't stay where they put them. They also are not always effective anymore. We have super weeds that are resistant to different chemicals. And then the third high cost, of course, is to our health. And no nation can afford to have a significant portion of their population chronically ill, and that's where we're heading toward. Doesn't matter what kind of healthcare system you have, if most of your people are sick or a significant number or percentage are sick, you're going to go broke, and the nation is going to fail. And that's where we're headed. And so those are the kind of things that I'm pointing out and trying to ring a bell of warning, but most of the book is on solutions to that. It's just not, you know, woe is me book. It's let's worry about this or that or the other crisis. But it's really focused around solutions. What we can do, and what I've seen is solutions on my farm and converting it from a chemical-based industrial system to a regenerative organic system. How we've tried to grow more and more of our own food. And as an example of what we can do, even on the prairies of north central Montana, where it's very hot in summer and cold in the winter and very low rainfall, and yet there's many things we can do to feed ourselves. And start to look at food, reconnect food and nutrition and food and health. And once we do that, then we can understand why it's important to pay more for our food, why the food, good food and nutritious food has a higher value, and give us reasons, economic reasons, to adapt a different system than we have now. That really is only benefiting big pharma and big multinational chemical industrial complex.
We're going to pay for it one way or the other.
Yes.
We might as well get our
pay now
dollars
or pay later. That's right. And you can have a lot more fun if you're not sick all the time. I forget some of that. That was good. Thank you. I haven't done that since my kids are little.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please like us and subscribe and tell your friends. That's how we keep going.
We want to thank Bob for having us out today. If you'd like more information, please visit his website at bobquinorganicfarmer.com. Also, please look for the book he co-authored with Liz Carlisle entitled Grain by Grain, available online and in stores now. If you'd like to try some of Big Sandy Organic's Cracklin' Kamut that Bob mentioned, please go to cracklinkamut.com. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for more upcoming episodes from our travels. We'd also like to thank our producer, Michelle Council. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions, all rights reserved, copyright 2019.